That is Master Conguero, composer and band leader, Poncho Sanchez with Conga Blue. It's from his 1999 album, Latin Soul. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. A four-year tentative contract negotiated between the Auto Workers Union and Fiat Chrysler in Detroit appears headed for recall. More than 40,000 members of the UAW currently are voting on whether to ratify the contract, but so far the UAW's largest locals have voted against the deal. Greg Gardner, a labor reporter for the Detroit Free Press, explains why workers are against the contract and whether their thumbs down on it is a harbinger of contract negotiations with Ford and General Motors yet to come. The big three auto manufacturers employ more than 141,000 workers. Thanks, Greg, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been covering this for a long time, and you noted in your most recent piece that the largest locals are not going for the contract. Why?
Well, there are a variety of reasons, and I can't speak for every rank-and-file worker, but the biggest sore point is a perception throughout the union's Chrysler department that 4 years ago the company and the union agreed that in this year's contract there would be a limit of 25% on the portion of hourly workers who could be paid at the lower wage second tier level. The agreement they're voting on does not have such a limit. And people are pretty upset about that.
One of the things that happened, one of the things that actually was unearthed was that it seemed as if part of the, while this negotiation was going on over the contract, the auto manufacturers raised a kind of cudgel against the workers saying, listen, if you don't go along with this, there's always Mexico. Can you tell us what they did with that?
Well, I don't think that was explicitly part of the negotiations. That is a backdrop that has been in play for several years now. And separate from the negotiations, Fiat Chrysler did talk about shifting certain products in such a way that most, if not all, their small and medium-sized cars would be eventually assembled in Mexico. And essentially the U.S. plants would be devoted to truck, SUV, and crossover vehicles. So, but that's been an issue for several years.
But based on the way things are going, mm-hmm. is there a sense among the workers that the union leadership essentially has made way too many concessions in this round of negotiation?
Well, that perception does exist within Fiat Chrysler. I would not generalize and say it's also as strong at the other two companies. Part of the reason is that Chrysler has the highest percentage of the Tier 2 workers. It's up around 43%, according to the UAW. It's roughly 20% at GM, and actually it's capped at Ford at 20%. So in that respect, the union feels that Fiat Chrysler already has an advantage on labor costs, but it's less profitable in North America than Ford or Chrysler, or Ford or GM. Therefore, the profit-sharing checks that they get every year have been smaller than what their brothers and sisters at GM and Ford have received.
One of the things that the workers did do was authorize the union to take a strike, to effect a strike. And that was supposed to have been their cudgel against the automobile manufacturers if the negotiations didn't go right. Based on the rejection by the largest worker, largest locals so far, is it possible that, one, the discontent will spread, and you will find more and more locals turning down the tentative contract. And two, do you think it might even come to a demand that they go on strike?
Okay, let's answer your first question. And to bring the voting up to date, there was a large local here in Metro Detroit that voted yesterday. And among the production workers, the people on the line, they approved it by 53% to 47%. The skilled trades people who do the work on the equipment, electricians, millwrights, and so forth, they voted against it, but their numbers are smaller. So that was a key local that voted narrowly in favor. So it's a little bit like waiting up for election returns on election night, and it's close, but we haven't heard from California, okay? So, you know, it's mathematically possible that they can come up with enough votes to get a ratification, but it's not a sure thing. Now, your second question was, if it's rejected, could there be a strike? There could. That is the ultimate decision that the leadership of the union has to make. My hunch is that they don't want to do that because they have other options that aren't that bad, specifically going to one of the other two companies and trying to address the issues that the people at Fiat Chrysler were most upset about and get a better agreement, essentially.
That could happen. How are negotiations going with Ford?
Well, they're on hold now because historically what happens is they all negotiate simultaneously through most of the summer up through around Labor Day, and then they focus on one company. And Dennis Williams, the UAW president, chose to focus on Fiat Chrysler. And then when you get an agreement with that target company, then the ratification process begins. So that's where we are now. They're on hold. The talks are on hold, essentially, at Ford and General Motors.
The tenor, though, I'm interested in what you read about the tenor of the workers, the attitudes that, mm-hmm. that they have within this particular time of negotiation, and what it says about the workers' relationship with their union leadership.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Without going, into too much detail, it's important to recognize that the dynamics at Fiat Chrysler are different. They're different for a variety of reasons. There was a problematic former, vice president of that department who's since passed away. There's bad feelings left over from his tenure. There's also a general feeling that, among the older people that they've sacrificed for basically a decade without getting an increase in their base wage. And among the younger people, there was an expectation that they would move up to the full, pay scale sooner. And the agreement doesn't call for that. They would get raises, don't get me wrong, but they would not eliminate the pay difference between the senior workers and the post-2007 workers.
All of this is happening in a Detroit that is still reeling from bankruptcy and huge budget deficits and lots of sacrifice going on. How does this fit into the city of Detroit, in the city of Detroit now?
Well, I guess I would I would qualify your observation. I mean, the city itself is doing pretty well right now, and the industry is doing even better. We're looking at possibly 17.5 million new vehicles sold in the U.S. this year, which is higher than at any point back during the housing bubble. So times are good in that respect. The profits are so much bigger here in the U.S. and North America that they're eclipsing the losses that most of these companies are reporting in other regions of the country, especially Europe and to a lesser degree South America. So, I mean, the union points to that as well, saying, listen, we're helping you make this huge profit, you know, that, and we expect to be rewarded for that.
Well, I was talking really about individual Detroiters, considering that the workforce is going to be, of course, reflective of the city of Detroit more so than outside of Detroit. When you have this kind of a situation occurring during labor negotiations and there's all this rancor going on and people are very upset, how does that compound what is already a stressful situation in the city of Detroit for
just
Detroiters?
Just judging on the feedback we get from readers, I mean, it is quite polarized, and you know, there are people who kind of think that the regional and local economy would be much better off if the UAW fades away. On the other hand, it's already shrunk pretty radically, and there are a lot of people who say this is the last resort. I mean, if the union can't protect itself and its members in good times, you know, does it have a future?
Could you talk a bit about that profit, how it is that even as Detroit, the city, and regular Detroiters are coping with the aftermath of forced bankruptcy, how it is that the city of Detroit right now is still doing really, really well. And this auto industry, despite the fact that it took quite a walloping, is doing very well. It, of course, was bailed out, but it is doing very well. Could you explain that?
Well, are you speaking to the city or to the industry in the metropolitan area?
Because the industry. The industry is being an intricate part, of course, of the fiscal health of the city.
Absolutely. I agree completely. Well, essentially, you're talking about, you know, the average price of a new vehicle is now in the neighborhood of $32,000. And, I mean, you have pickup trucks now that are selling between $50,000 and $60,000. Those are incredibly profitable vehicles. Labor has become a smaller part of the cost structure over time because of automation, because of, you know, work practices that are simply more competitive than they were, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. And, you know, there are those who say, well, yeah, but that's what profit sharing is all about, so you can share in the success. The rank and file point to profit sharing and say, well, it's nice to get a check, but, you know, after taxes, I only get to keep, you know, 60% of it. And we're talking about our base wages, which for the older workers have not risen in essentially 10 years.
Fiat Chrysler, there's a huge irony here. Here's a company that basically went belly up. It benefited greatly from a federal intervention, from a federal bailout, which allowed a foreign company, if you will, Fiat, to acquire an American company. Yet the United States took a $10 billion hit on just that one alone. Could you talk about what the forecast is of Fiat Chrysler and whether there has been any attempt whatsoever to recover the money that the United States bailed out with?
Okay, their bankruptcy restructuring was different from General Motors in that the government took primarily a debt position, which the company has paid back. Now, there were other forms of aid that may not have been totally repaid, but the loss on the government's investment was larger at General Motors, largely because they took an equity stake. They had stock in the new company, and they sold it at a point that was the stock was doing better, but you know it wasn't enough to recover, you know, the taxpayers' total investment. But you were also asking about the outlook for Fiat Chrysler.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the irony, you're absolutely right to point that out. because right now Chrysler is financially carrying the Fiat side of the business. And again, it gets back to this mix of vehicles. It's simply a truism that pickup trucks and SUVs are more profitable than passenger cars. And more than 70% of what the Chrysler and its affiliated brands sell in the U.S. are what are called light trucks. So, yeah, I mean, the problem is, though, they're not quite as profitable in terms of their margin as General Motors and Ford. And that, why is that? That strikes to the heart of what these contract talks are all about. The company will say, well, we have to continue to put pressure on our labor costs, and the union saying, well, wait a minute, you know, your labor costs as a percentage of the price of a vehicle are already lower than your two competitors. They're lower than even some of the Asians in the U.S. And you got to look elsewhere. You got to look to, you know, how many brands of vehicles you have and so on.
Plus a bloated management, an overpaid management, poor management.
These are
some of the things that the workers have been pointing out. So what happens now? What's with the vote and where does it go? What's the timeline?
Okay. Well, we should know something by late tomorrow or early Thursday, and then the leadership of the union will have to make some difficult decisions. I think it's more likely that they'll go to one of the other companies than call a strike.
Well, thanks, Greg, for bringing us up to date, and I know you'll be following, so we may call on you again real soon. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you. Well, we'll be following this because this is huge. This is a big, big issue, although you may not be immediately located in an automobile manufacturing hub. But you have 141,000 people involved here in a particular industry. This was the industry that assisted the branching out of a lot of people, hundreds of thousands over several years, from just barely surviving to making a decent wage and lifting them into what our president prides himself in calling the middle class. But beyond that, it helped to build a city and build beyond the city, because a lot of folks working in Detroit were supporting families in the South and even in the North, and they were a hub for the stability of a large chunk of America. So we'll be following that as things develop. But I want to talk about yesterday at the United Nations. It was the opening of the 70th United Nations General Assembly in the city of New York. And of course, at the General Assembly, you have representatives, heads of state of many, many countries coming together to discuss problems that they share and concerns that they have for the whole world. And of course, to make a plea in an open forum for some kind of sanity to prevail. And as you know, it's usually the case where the big guys dominate the little guys. And at these speeches, when they make these speeches, it's usually they sound so good. Everybody's innocent. Everybody wants to do the right thing. So the axis of leadership kind of fell on the persons of Barack Obama representing the United States. We have Xi Jinping of China. We had Vladimir Putin of Russia. So the big guys were out there and they were talking. First, I want to share with you what our president, Barack Obama, said yesterday at the opening of the 70th General Assembly. And we will follow. It's a pretty long clip, but we will not be able to hear the entire thing because he spoke twice as long as most everybody else. So you will hear a sizable portion of what it is he had to say. We may discuss this further on Free Your Mind Friday, but we will also hear from Vladimir Putin, and you'll see how diametrically opposed their interpretations of the world and its reality, its geopolitics, you'll hear how crazily different it is. So first, let's hear from President Obama, and we will hear after that Vladimir Putin discussing their concerns as heads of state of leading nations of the world.
Those who argue that the ideals enshrined in the UN Charter are unachievable, we're out of date, a legacy of a post-war era not suited to our own. Effectively, they argue for a return to the rules that applied for most of human history and that predate this institution. The belief that power is a zero-sum game, that might makes right, that strong states must impose their will on weaker ones, that the rights of individuals don't matter, and that in a time of rapid change, order must be imposed by force. On this basis, we see some major powers assert themselves in ways that contravene international law. We see an erosion of the democratic principles and human rights that are fundamental to this institution's mission. Information is strictly controlled, the space for civil society restricted. We're told that such retrenchment is required to beat back disorder, that it's the only way to stamp out terrorism or prevent foreign meddling. In accordance with this logic, we should support tyrants like Bashar al-Assad, who drops barrel bombs to massacre innocent children, because the alternative is surely worse. The increasing skepticism of our international order can also be found in the most advanced democracies. We see greater polarization, more frequent gridlock, movements on the far right and sometimes the left that insist on stopping the trade that binds our fates to other nations, calling for the building of walls to keep out immigrants. And most ominously, we see the fears of ordinary people being exploited through appeals to sectarianism, or tribalism, or racism, or anti-Semitism. Appeals to a glorious past before the body politic was infected by those who look different or worship God differently. A politics of us versus them. The United States is not immune from this. Even as our economy is growing and our troops have largely returned from Iraq and Afghanistan, we see in our debates about America's role in the world a notion of strength that is defined by opposition to old enemies, perceived adversaries, a rising China, or a resurgent Russia, a revolutionary Iran, or an Islam that is incompatible with peace. We see an argument made that the only strength that matters for the United States is bellicose words and shows of military force, that cooperation and diplomacy will not work. As President of the United States, I am mindful of the dangers that we face. They cross my desk every morning. I lead the strongest military that the world has ever known, and I will never hesitate to protect my country or our allies unilaterally and by force where necessary. But I stand before you today believing in my core that we, the nations of the world, cannot return to the old ways of conflict and coercion. We cannot look backwards. We live in an integrated world, one in which we all have a stake in each other's success. We cannot turn back those forces of integration. No nation in this assembly can insulate itself from the threat of terrorism or the risk of financial contagion, the flow of migrants, or the danger of a warming planet. The disorder we see is not driven solely by competition between nations or any single ideology. And if we cannot work together more effectively, we will all suffer the consequences. That is true for the United States as well. No matter how powerful our military, how strong our economy, we understand the United States cannot solve the world's problems alone. In Iraq, the United States learned the hard lesson that even hundreds of thousands of brave, effective troops, trillions of dollars from our treasury, cannot by itself impose stability on a foreign land. Unless we work with other nations under the mantle of international norms and principles and law that offer legitimacy to our efforts, we will not succeed. And unless we work together to defeat the ideas that drive different communities in a country like Iraq into conflict, any order that our militaries can impose will be temporary. And just as force alone cannot impose order internationally, I believe in my core that repression cannot forge the social cohesion for nations to succeed. The history of the last two decades proves that in today's world, dictatorships are unstable. The strong men of today become the spark of revolution tomorrow. You can jail your opponents, but you can't imprison ideas. You can try to control access to information, but you cannot turn a lie into truth. It is not a conspiracy of U.S.-backed NGOs that expose corruption and raise the expectations of people around the globe. It's technology, social media, and the irreducible desire of people everywhere to make their own choices about how they are governed. Indeed, I believe that in today's world, the measure of strength is no longer defined by the control of territory. Lasting prosperity does not come solely from the ability to access and extract raw materials. The strength of nations depends on the success of their people, their knowledge, their innovation, their imagination, their creativity, their drive, their opportunity, and that in turn depends on individual rights and good governance and personal security. Internal repression and foreign aggression are both symptoms of the failure to provide this foundation. A politics of solidarity that depend on demonizing others, that draws on religious sectarianism or narrow tribalism or jingoism, may at times look like strength in the moment, but over time its weakness will be exposed. And history tells us that the dark forces unleashed by this type of politics surely makes all of us less secure. Our world has been there before. We gain nothing from going back. Instead, I believe that we must go forward in pursuit of our ideals, not abandon them at this critical time. We must give expression to our best hopes, not our deepest fears. This institution was founded because men and women who came before us had the foresight to know that our nations are more secure when we uphold basic laws and basic norms and pursue a path of cooperation over conflict. And strong nations, above all, have a responsibility to uphold this international order. Let me give you a concrete example. After I took office, I made clear that one of the principal achievements of this body, the nuclear nonproliferation regime, was endangered by Iran's violation of the NPT. On that basis, the Security Council tightened sanctions on the Iranian government, and many nations joined us to enforce them. Together, we showed that laws and agreements mean something. But we also understood that the goal of sanctions was not simply to punish Iran. Our objective was to test whether Iran could change course, accept constraints, and allow the world to verify that its nuclear program will be peaceful. For 2 years, the United States and our partners, including Russia, including China, stuck together in complex negotiations. The result is a lasting, comprehensive deal that prevents Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon while allowing it to access peaceful energy. And if this deal is fully implemented, the prohibition on nuclear weapons is strengthened, a potential war is averted, our world is safer. That is the strength of the international system when it works the way it should. That same fidelity to international order guides our responses to other challenges around the world. Consider Russia's annexation of Crimea and further aggression in eastern Ukraine. America has few economic interests in Ukraine. We recognize the deep and complex history between Russia and Ukraine. But we cannot stand by when the sovereignty and territorial integrity of a nation is flagrantly violated. If that happens without consequence in Ukraine, it could happen to any nation gathered here today. That's the basis of the sanctions that the United States and our partners impose on Russia. It's not a desire to return to a Cold War. Now, within Russia, state-controlled media may describe these events as an example of a resurgent Russia. A view shared, by the way, by a number of U.S. Politicians and commentators who have always been deeply skeptical of Russia and seem to be convinced a new Cold War is, in fact, upon us. And yet, look at the results. The Ukrainian people are more interested than ever in aligning with Europe instead of Russia. Sanctions have led to capital flight, a contracting economy, a fallen ruble, and the emigration of more educated Russians. Imagine if instead Russia had engaged in true diplomacy and worked with Ukraine and the international community to ensure its interests were protected. That would be better for Ukraine, but also better for Russia and better for the world, which is why we continue to press for this crisis to be resolved in a way that allows a sovereign and democratic Ukraine to determine its future and control its territory. Not because we want to isolate Russia, we don't, but because we want a strong Russia that's invested in working with us to strengthen the international system as a whole. Similarly, in the South China Sea, the United States makes no claim on territory there. We don't adjudicate claims. But like every nation gathered here, we have an interest in upholding the basic principles of freedom of navigation and the free flow of commerce, and in resolving disputes through international law, not the law of force. So we will defend these principles while encouraging China and other claimants to resolve their differences peacefully. I say this recognizing that diplomacy is hard, that the outcomes are sometimes unsatisfying, that it's rarely politically popular. But I believe that leaders of large nations, in particular, have an obligation to take these risks, precisely because we are strong enough to protect our interests if and when diplomacy fails. I also believe that to move forward in this new era, we have to be strong enough to acknowledge when what you're doing is not working. For 50 years, the United States pursued a Cuba policy that failed to improve the lives of the Cuban people. We changed that. We continue to have differences with the Cuban government. We will continue to stand up for human rights, but we address these issues through diplomatic relations and increased commerce and people-to-people ties. As these contacts yield progress, I'm confident that our Congress will inevitably lift an embargo that should not be in place anymore. Change won't come overnight to Cuba, but I'm confident that openness, not coercion, will support the reforms and better the life the Cuban people deserve. Just as I believe that Cuba will find its success if it pursues cooperation with other nations. Now, if it's in the interest of major powers to uphold international standards, it is even more true for the rest of the community of nations. Look around the world. From Singapore to Colombia to Senegal, the facts show that nations succeed when they pursue an inclusive peace and prosperity within their borders and work cooperatively with countries beyond their borders. That path is now available to a nation like Iran, which, as of this moment, continues to deploy violent proxies to advance its interests. These efforts may appear to give Iran leverage in disputes with neighbors, but they fuel sectarian conflict that endangers the entire region and isolates Iran from the promise of trade and commerce. The Iranian people have a proud history and are filled with extraordinary potential. But chanting death to America does not create jobs or make Iran more secure. If Iran chooses a different path, that would be good for the security of the region, good for the Iranian people, and good for the world.
And government. Ladies and gentlemen, the 70th anniversary of the United Nations is a good occasion to both take stock of history and talk about our common future. In 1945, the countries that defeated Nazism joined their efforts to lay solid foundations for the post-war world order. Let me remind you that the key decisions on the principles guiding the cooperation among states, as well as on the establishment of the United Nations, were made in our country, in Yalta, at the meeting of the anti-Hitler coalition leaders. The Yalta system was actually born in travail. It was born at the cost of tens of millions of lives and two world wars. They swept through the planet in the 20th century. Let us be fair. It helped the humanity through turbulent, at times dramatic, events of the last 7 decades. It saved the world from large-scale upheavals. The United Nations is unique in its legitimacy, representation, and universality. It is true that lately the UN has been widely criticized for supposedly not being efficient enough and for the fact that the decision-making on fundamental issues stalls due to insurmountable differences, first of all, among the members of the Security Council. However, I would like to point out that there have always been differences in the UN throughout all these 70 years of existence. The veto right has always been exercised by the United States, the United Kingdom, France, China, the Soviet Union, and Russia later alike. It is absolutely natural for so diverse and representative an organization. When the UN was established, its founders did not in the least think that there would always be unanimity. The mission of the organization is to seek and reach compromises, and its strength comes from taking different views and opinions into consideration. The decisions debated within the UN are either taken as resolutions or not. As diplomats say, they either pass or do not pass. Whatever actions any state might take by passing this procedure are illegitimate. They run counter to the UN Charter and defy international law. We all know that after the end of the Cold War, everyone is aware of that, a single center of domination emerged in the world, and then those who found themselves at the top of the pyramid were tempted to think that if they were so strong and exceptional, they knew better, and they do not have to reckon with the UN, which instead of automatically authorize and legitimize the necessary decisions, often creates obstacles or, in other words, stands in the way. It has now become commonplace to say that it is in its original form has become obsolete and completed its historical mission. Of course, the world is changing, and the UN must be consistent with this natural transformation. Russia stands ready to work together with its partners on the basis of broad consensus. But we consider the attempts to undermine the legitimacy of the United Nations as extremely dangerous. They could lead to a collapse of the entire architecture of international relations, and then, indeed, there would be no other rules left but the rule of force. We would get a world dominated by selfishness rather than collective work, a world increasingly characterized by dictate rather than equality. There would be less of genuine democracy and freedom, and there would be a world where truly independent states would be replaced by an ever-growing number of de facto protectorates and externally controlled territories. What is the state sovereignty, after all, that has been mentioned by our colleagues here? It is basically about freedom and the right to choose freely one's own future for every person, nation, or state. By the way, dear colleagues, the same holds true of the question of the so-called legitimacy of state authority. One should not play with or manipulate words. Every term in international law and international affairs should be clear, transparent, and have uniformly understood criteria. We are all different, and we should respect that. No one has to conform to a single development model that someone has once and for all recognized as the only right one. We should all remember what our past has taught us. We also remember certain episodes from the history of the Soviet Union, social experiments for export, attempts to push for changes within other countries based on ideological preferences, often led to tragic consequences and to degradation rather than progress. It seems, however, that far from learning from others' mistakes, everyone just keeps repeating them. And so the export of revolutions, this time of so-called democratic ones, continues. It would suffice to look at the situation in the Middle East and North Africa, as has been mentioned by my previous speaker, certainly. Political and social problems in this region have been piling up for a long time, and people there wished for changes naturally. But how did it actually turn out? rather than bringing about reforms and aggressive foreign interference, has resulted in a brazen destruction of national institutions and the lifestyle itself. Instead of the triumph of democracy and progress, we got violence, poverty, and social disaster. And nobody cares a bit about human rights, including the right to life. I cannot help asking those who have caused this situation, do you realize now what you've done? But I'm afraid no one is going to answer that. Indeed, policy is based on self-conceit and belief in one's exceptionality and impunity have never been abandoned. It is now obvious that the power vacuum created in some countries of the Middle East and North Africa led to the emergence of anarchy areas, which immediately started to be filled with extremists and terrorists. Tens of thousands of militants are fighting under the banners of the so-called Islamic State. Its ranks include former Iraqi servicemen who were thrown out into the street after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Many recruits also come from Libya, a country whose statehood was destroyed as a result of a gross violation of the UN Security Council Resolution 1973. And now the ranks of radicals are being joined by the members of the so-called modern Syrian opposition supported by the Western countries. First, they are armed and trained, and then they defect to the so-called Islamic State. Besides, the Islamic State itself did not just come from nowhere. It was also initially forged as a tool against undesirable secular regimes. Having established a foothold in Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State has become actively expanding to other regions. It is seeking dominance in the Islamic world. And not only there, and its plans go further than that. The situation is more than dangerous. In these circumstances, it is hypocritical and irresponsible to make loud declarations about the threat of international terrorism while turning a blind eye to the channels of financing and supporting terrorists, including the process of drug trafficking and illicit trade in oil and arms. It would be equally irresponsible to try to manipulate extremist groups and place them at one's service in order to achieve one's own political goals in the hope of later dealing with them or, in other words, liquidating them. To those who do so, I would like to say, dear sirs, no doubt you're dealing with rough and cruel people, but they are no way primitive or silly. They are just as clever as you are, and you never know who is manipulating whom. And the recent data on arms transfer to this most moderate opposition is the best proof of it. We believe that any attempts to play games with terrorists, let alone to arm them, are not just short-sighted, but fire-hazardous. This may result in the global terrorist threat increasing dramatically and engulfing new regions, especially given that Islamic State camps train militants from many countries, including the European countries. Unfortunately, dear colleagues, I have to put it frankly, Russia is not an exception. We cannot allow these criminals who have already tasted blood to return back home and continue their evil doings. No one wants this to happen. Does he? Russia has always been consistently fighting against terrorism in all its forms. Today we provide military and technical assistance both to Iraq and Syria and many other countries of the region who are fighting terrorist groups. We think it is an enormous mistake to refuse to cooperate with the Syrian government and its armed forces who are valiantly fighting terrorism face to face. We should finally acknowledge that No one but President Assad's armed forces and Kurds militia are truly fighting the Islamic State and other terrorist organizations in Syria. We know about all the problems and contradictions in the region, but which should be based on the reality.
Dear colleagues, I must note that such an honest and frank approach of Russia has been recently used as a pretext to accuse it of its growing ambitions, as if those who say it have no ambitions at all. However, it's not about Russia's ambitions, dear colleagues, but about the recognition of the fact that we can no longer tolerate the current state of affairs in the world. What we actually propose is to be guided by common values and common interests rather than ambitions. On the basis of international law, we must join efforts to address the problems that all of us are facing and create a genuinely broad international coalition against terrorism. Similar to the anti-Hitler coalition, it could unite a broad range of forces that are resolutely resisting those who, just like the Nazis, sow evil and hatred of humankind. And naturally, the Muslim countries are to play a key role in the coalition, even more so because the Islamic State does not only pose a direct threat to them, but also desecrates one of the greatest world religions by its bloody crimes. The ideologists of militants make a mockery of Islam and pervert its true humanistic values. I would like to address Muslim spiritual leaders as well. Your authority and your guidance are of great importance right now. It is essential to prevent people recruited by militants from making hasty decisions, and those who have already been deceived and who, due to various circumstances, found themselves among terrorists need help in finding a way back to normal life, laying down arms and putting an end to fratricide. Russia will shortly convene, as the current president of the Security Council, a ministerial meeting to carry out a comprehensive analysis of threats in the Middle East. First of all, we propose discussing whether it is possible to agree on a resolution aimed at coordinating the actions of all the forces that confront the Islamic State and other terrorist organizations. Once again, this coordination should be based on the principles of the UN Charter. We hope that the international community will be able to develop a comprehensive strategy of political stabilization as well as social and economic recovery of the Middle East. Then, dear friends, there would be no need for new refugee camps. Today, the flow of people who were forced to leave their homeland has literally engulfed first neighboring countries and then Europe itself. There are hundreds of thousands of them now, and there might be millions before long. In fact, it is a new, great, and tragic migration of peoples, and it is a harsh lesson for all of us, including Europe. I would like to stress, refugees undoubtedly need our compassionate support. However, the only way to solve this problem at a fundamental level is to restore the statehood where it has been destroyed, to strengthen the government institutions where they still exist or are being reestablished, to provide comprehensive assistance of military, economic, and material nature to countries in a difficult situation, and certainly to those people who, despite all the ordeals, will not abandon their homes. Naturally, any assistance to sovereign states can and must be offered rather than imposed exclusively and solely in accordance with the UN Charter. In other words, everything in this field that is being done or will be done pursuant to the norms of international law must be supported by our organization. Everything that contravenes the UN Charter must be rejected. Above all, I believe it is of the utmost importance to help restore government's institutions in Libya, support the new government of Iraq, and provide comprehensive assistance to the legitimate government of Syria. Dear colleagues, Ensuring peace and regional and global stability remains the key objective of the international community with the UN at its helm. We believe this means creating a space of equal and indivisible security, which is not for the select few, but for everyone. Yes, it is a challenging, complicated, and time-consuming task, but there is simply no other alternative. However, the bloc thinking of the times of the Cold War and the desire to explore new geopolitical areas is still present among some of our colleagues. First, they continued their policy of expanding NATO. What for if the Warsaw Bloc stopped its existence? The Soviet Union had collapsed, and nevertheless, the NATO continues expanding, as well as its military infrastructure. Then they offered the poor Soviet countries a false choice. Either to be with the West or with the East. Sooner or later, this logic of confrontation was bound to spark off a grave geopolitical crisis. This is exactly what happened in Ukraine, where the discontent of population with the current authorities was used and a military coup was orchestrated from outside that triggered a civil war as a result. We're confident that only through full and faithful implementation of the Minsk agreements of February 12, 2015, can we put an end to the bloodshed and find a way of the deadlock. Ukraine's territorial integrity cannot be ensured by threats of force and force of arms. What is needed is a genuine consideration for the interests and rights of the people in the Donbas region and respect for their choice. There is a need to coordinate with them as provided for by the Minsk agreements, the key elements of the country's political structure. These steps will guarantee that Ukraine will develop as a civilized state as an essential link in building a common space of security and economic cooperation both in Europe and in Eurasia. Ladies and gentlemen, I have mentioned this common space of economic cooperation on purpose. Not long ago, it seemed that in the economic sphere with its objective market laws, we would learn to live without dividing lines. We would build on transparent and jointly formulated rules, including the WTO principles stipulating the freedom of trade and investment and open competition. Nevertheless, today, unilateral sanctions circumventing the UN Charter have become almost commonplace. In addition to pursuing political objectives, these sanctions serve as a means of eliminating competitors. I would like to point out another sign of a growing economic selfishness. Some countries have chosen to create closed and exclusive economic associations, with the establishment being negotiated behind the scenes, in secret, from those countries' own citizens, the general public, business community, and from other countries.
So there we have it. We have one world leader who went into full professorial mode, lecturing the world about international affairs, but we had several others who conducted teach-ins instead, and those teach-ins seemed to have corrected the teacher's syllabus. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure and a great privilege to be with you always, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.